So welcome to the Core Children's Museum of Greater Chicago Playbook Podcast. We're doing a series of these to talk about the role of the museum and the essential role that we play in early childhood education and development. And today I'm absolutely thrilled that we're having a conversation about brain development, something that I know is of interest to everybody who's raising a young child. And we are very privileged to have a conversation today with Dr. Lise Elliott. And Dr. Elliott is the professor of neuroscience at the college at the Chicago Medical School at Rosalind Franklin University. Dr. Elliott, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself before we start the conversation?
Oh, I'd be happy to. So I'm a neuroscientist and I teach medical students and PhD students at Chicago Medical School of Rosalind Franklin University. My background in research actually started at the cellular level, and I was trying to understand how synapses change as a result of experience, which we now know is the basis for learning. And then I started having children, and I became kind of obsessively curious about how their own little synapses were changing. So I stepped away from bench research to write a book on brain development called What's Going On in There, about brain development the first 5 years, well, from conception on, really. And then I wrote a second book called Pink Brain, Blue Brain, where I explored gender differences in development and the brain and the sort of interplay between nature and nurture there.
Wonderful. Well, what we want to talk about today is building off your great expertise and sort of the relevance and how an organization or an entity like a children's museum can play a role in brain development of young children. The museum, we're focused on children age birth to eight. We're located in Glenview,
Illinois.
And we try to stay up on child development research, what current theories and practices say, and how we can best adapt our programming and the kinds of activities we do with children and parents to optimize learning. And I myself have sat in a lot of programs where I've heard about the synaptic structures and the rate at which the structures, these connections are being made in the brain of an infant. But what really is discouraging to me is when I sometimes hear a parent say, oh, we won't bring our child to the museum until they're about two because we don't think they're going to get anything out of it. What would your reaction be to that, given what you know about how an infant's brain is developing and how you would counter that comment from a parent?
There's an answer to the title of my book, What's Going On in There. There's a tremendous amount going on in children's brains, you know, even from the last trimester, throughout life, obviously, but I mean, learning is kind of exponentially decays. Unfortunately, we take in much, much more in the first few years of life than we do later on, which doesn't mean we can't learn things, but what I mean is our basic circuits are being put together in the first few years, and so kind of every experience is, triply important for a young child. You know, a lot of parents have interpreted that as, stimulation is really important for my baby's brain. And of course, visiting a children's museum is very stimulating. But what we really mean is that interaction is what's important for babies' brains.
Tell us more about that, Dr. Elliott. What do you mean by interaction?
Sure. The brain's processing everything. And so if you assault it with stimuli, it'll certainly activate many circuits, but they won't necessarily be coherent or meaningful. And what's most meaningful to children, and especially infants, is social interaction. So anything that a parent can do with a child that gives you a chance to focus on new sights and sounds and experiences will basically scaffold the child's learning, give them something to hang on to as they try to make sense of the world. So we look for parents to be interacting with their children, to be reading to them, to be telling them stories and singing them songs. I'm sure going to a museum is kind of like reading a good storybook in that it exposes a child to things outside their immediate environment. It's not just the same old bottle and blankie, but, you know, you're seeing new physical objects and elements of chemistry and physics and the world around you that aren't necessarily found inside your own home. So another way to tell stories with a child is to bring them to parks and playgrounds and museums and music concerts.
Yes, you've picked up on a lot of the things that we pay close attention to. It's not only the activities in the museum and providing a broad array of activities from blocks to art to STEM, STEAM-related activities, and including activities out in our outdoor exhibit space, Habitat Park. But can you give too much stimulation? Can there be too much interaction?
Well, there definitely can be too much stimulation, and babies are usually pretty good at letting you know if they're overstimulated. They'll get fussy, or they'll just kind of shut down. I mean, we all know a great way to put young babies to sleep is to turn on the vacuum cleaner.
Or go for a ride in the car, right?
Yeah, or hang out next to the washing machine. So, well, for one thing, young infants don't hear sounds as loudly as we do, so that's part of the reason they don't get distressed by that. But as important as experiences and stimuli are to a baby's brain, they don't have the capacity to organize and process them and filter out the less meaningful ones in the ways that we do. So what caregivers can do is actually serve as that filter rather than a child just drowning in unfamiliar things. What the parent does is focus the child's attention. Young infants are super aware of other people's attention. We actually call that joint attention, beginning about 3 months of age, when babies can start following a caregiver's eye movements to figure out what you're interested in. It grows dramatically over the first year of life, and we know that's an important way babies learn, is by taking note of what you're taking note of, because you're essentially curating the environment for them and showing them what's important and interesting.
So you're very much talking about the kind of interaction that is very feedback related. It's very action oriented. So the caregiver or the parent does something, the child does something, and they each respond to each other and feed off of each other, right?
Exactly. Some have likened it to a dance with this reciprocity. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It's absolutely as important that the parent is responding to what the child is babbling or looking at or pointing to, because there's nothing more reinforcing than knowing others are listening and paying attention to what you're trying to communicate. Another point about early interaction is that young children learn a vast majority of what they learn through imitation. So by watching a parent, you know, even at a museum, if the child is too young to meaningfully, you know, put the blocks together or pour fluid through the funnel, they can certainly learn from watching, so that as they get more coordinated, they will have had that sensory experience that they can kind of rely on as they start testing their own motor skills.
And the modeling. I know one of the things that we love to see in the museum is when a caregiver is involved with their child. And even though something might happen that was not anticipated, i.e. they build the tower and all of a sudden it falls down, it's that joyous laughter at it falling down rather than you got it wrong. So it's the positive feedback and the affirmation giving a child confidence in their learning.
Yes, and modeling is the most kind of explicit way we do this, but parents also scaffold as their children get a little more capable and they're on the cusp of a new skill but can't quite line those blocks up correctly. When the parent is able to nudge the child's work just a little bit further so that it's more successful, then that gives the child success and confidence for moving to the next stage.
So how would you say that a playful environment affects the brain? And I'm kind of asking you to compare a playful environment versus an environment where a child is in a very solitary environment. They're not getting the interactions. They've been stuck in front of the television or put into a playpen to basically fend for themselves. Talk a little bit about those different environments and how they impact brain development.
Well, I think it was Montessori who said play is the work of the child. Certainly that's become the mantra for how we think about early development, that all mammalian animals play as youngsters, and that's really their way of experimenting and exploring. And play is intrinsically pleasurable. You're following your own curiosity. It's relaxed. You know, there's no demands on you. And so it's really kind of the best way to explore and learn, because it's highly positive and motivating. So that's where toys came from. If you don't give a child a toy, they'll invent a toy out of a stick or a rag or whatever's at hand. But now, you know, we're kind of flooded with toys. And generally, that's a great thing. I'm sure your audience is familiar with the difference, you know, between educational and non-educational toys, things that really allow the child some creative exploration versus more programmed play styles.
Well, I love how you talk about intrinsic motivation. That's language that we use a lot when we're talking about different activities in the museum, whether it be through our professional development training that we're doing with teachers, or whether it be programming we're actually doing on the museum floor, or our educators who are interacting with families. We encourage that self-directed play and encourage parents to be the play partner, where the child can be the director of the learning. And it's the museum is actually one place where children do take control. And it's wonderful when we see them coming into the museum. And while parents are trying to figure out, am I a member? Do I have to pay? Where's my membership card? The children are off. They know where they're going and they are playing. But you talked about toys, and the museum is full of experiences that lead to open-ended play and different interactions. But back to toys, what would you say is a good toy?
Well, anything that is at the child's level and then pulling them a little bit beyond. So, you know, if you think of an infant stacking up donuts, the classic kind of rainbow donut stacker, you know, if they're just getting good control of their grasping and reaching, then that's the right time when you could use a toy like that, and they can practice reaching and letting go. And then as they start appreciating the differences in sizes, it becomes a challenge for them to order them by size. So the child may not be thinking of these different patterns yet, but that's where just a little nudge from the parent could say, oh, look, you know, we can put the big one on the bottom and it fits better. Or, you know, look at this pretty rainbow of colors, and then you can compare it to a rainbow produced by a prism. So the best playthings give some constraint of structure so that it's not, you know, completely all over the place, but also allows an opportunity for the child to invent on their own.
Another thing we've heard at the museum, picking up on that, is when we've designed exhibits and put exhibits together, some of them have relatively grown-up words. Like one of the exhibits we did on Science Plus U, one of the words was centrifuge. And we were talking to an organization who was going to host this exhibit for us. And they said, oh, we're going to have to make a lot of changes in the exhibit. And we said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, our children, four-year-olds, they don't know the word centrifuge. That word isn't in their vocabulary. And our response to that was, well, it soon will be. What's your response to that? Do we tend to dumb language down and words for children? Is that something we should do, or should we be using those bigger words?
Children learn an astounding astounding number of words. I think it amounts to something like 8 words a day over the course of the first 5 or 6 years of life. Of course, shorter words are easier than longer words, but that doesn't mean they're not capable of learning them, especially with very concrete experience. I mean, that's the beauty of a museum, a hands-on museum, where you can put physical connection with the actual words.
Right. And as you said, experience those words so they truly get the full understanding of the word for what it is, rather than just being a label, by hands-on interaction and experimentation. So we hear a lot about gender gaps in certain subjects in school and career fields. What can we do when children are young to help prevent some of those gaps when we're thinking about brain development?
Well, I think the most important thing parents can do is try to constantly challenge their own gender stereotypes. I mean, that is really the biggest source of divergence of boys and girls, is just our expectations about roles and assumptions about what they'll be interested in, what they'll be good at, and how we remark on children's abilities. So it's pretty clear that parents tend to be more focused on their sons' physical achievements and their daughters. Unfortunately, most parents are still more attentive to their daughter's physical beauty and weight. This is something, believe it or not, even in this day and age, parents can't help but remark on. So I think we need to constantly challenge that, encourage our daughters to take physical risks and be active, encourage our sons to keep their artistic and their verbal sides alive. Young boys and girls are equally empathetic and sensitive and caregiving when it comes to pets and younger children. And so I think this is something we need to continue to cultivate, especially in boys. Of course, girls get that opportunity if somebody hands them a baby doll, but it turns out little boys are just as interested in pushing dolls and strollers and taking care of pets and other vulnerable creatures.
In the museum, we try to make sure always to make all of our interactions and exhibit components very gender neutral. And we see girls and boys playing in the blocks, playing in the train exhibit area, playing in the grocery store, doing all of the activities, getting very engaged in our STEAM Explorers programs and working together to really explore and discover. And another beautiful one where we see so many levels of interaction is our pet vet and our baby nursery, where we see just great interactions between children and adults. Which brings me to another question. How do peer interactions, so children of similar ages, affect child's development?
Peer interactions are huge. Obviously, by the time a child is a preteen and an adolescent, that's their universe. They're much more interested and focused on what their peers are doing. But this does begin to happen as early as age 3. We know 3-year-olds are pretty keen on playing with others. They usually engage in what we call parallel play, where they enjoy the company, but they don't really quite have the social skills to take turns and engage directly with each other. But they enjoy playing side by side. And then beginning about 4, children become much more skillful at interactive play. For example, in the dramatic play corner, they can take on different roles and stay true to those roles in an interaction, you know, a shop owner and a customer, or a teacher and a pupil. And then they get a chance to trade roles is usually pretty fun.
Well, I think that's a lovely way of bringing us full circle back to where we started, Dr. Elliott, and thinking about the kinds of environments that the museum does provide that fosters that open-ended interaction and exploration, the opportunity for intrinsically motivated learning, and where children can just get down and play, and their parents and caregivers can have that permission to play with them as well, and how environments like the museum really stimulate brain development. I just wanted to take this opportunity to mention, too, for our listeners that the museum is going into a campaign so that we can grow even more and bring even more families and children into our wonderful environments, but also to take the programming out into the community via the pop-up.
You were telling me before about your pop-up museums, and I think that's fantastic. You know, whenever you can bring these experiences to more communities and more children, it's really encouraging.
Well, thank you. Well, we're thrilled to have the opportunity to do it. And thank you so much for joining us. This has been wonderful. And for more information, I encourage listeners to go to our website, which is www.colechildrensmuseum.org, or even better, just come see us. So, Dr. Elliott, thank you so much, and talk to you again soon.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you, Sheridan.
Thank you.